the new agreement between the Trump administration and Ukrainians. And here is what Donald Trump said about that.
A lot of things, obviously, we'll be discussing what's happening with respect to Ukraine and Russia. At this moment, we have people talking in Russia. We have representatives over there, Steve Witkoff and others, and they're in very serious discussions. As you know, Ukraine has agreed, subject to this, what's happening today, to a complete ceasefire, and we hope Russia will do the same. Thousands of people are being killed, young people, usually, mostly. Young people, we're just talking about it. Thousands of young people are being killed a week, and we want to see that stop. And they're not Americans, and they're not from the Netherlands for the most part.
No.
They're not from, they're from Russia, and they're from Ukraine. But they're people, and I think everybody feels the same way. We want it to stop. It's also a tremendous cost to the United States and to other countries. And it's something that would have never happened if I were president, and it makes me very angry to see that it did happen. But it happened, and we have to stop it. And Mark has done...
Here is what he said, Scott. And many people are arguing why, what's the main reason of talking about ceasefire while they're knowing that the, both parties, Ukrainians and Russians, are talking about they don't want to accept a ceasefire. But it was some sort of surprise for many people that the Russian president said he responded this way.
In this situation, I think the Ukrainian side might well want to achieve at least 30 days of ceasefire. And we're in favor of that, but there are nuances, though. Number one is what we're going to do with this sector of breached state border. If we stop the hostilities for 30 days, what it's going to mean? Is that, will that mean that everybody there is going to retreat without fighting? Are we going to have to let them go after all the atrocities they have perpetrated against civilians? Or the Ukrainian leadership will command them to lower their weapons, drop their weapons and just surrender? How is it going to look? That's still unclear. And what about other issues along the entire contact line, which is almost 2,000 kilometers? And as you know, Russian troops have been advancing almost all along the contact line. And there already conditions are favorable for us to surround and encircle whole military units. How are they going to use those 30 days? Is the ceasefire going to be used to continue forced mobilization, to continue rearming, to continue supplies of weaponry? To allow military units to regroup, but if nothing like this is done, then the question is bound to arise: how is control and verification is going to go? How are we guaranteed that nothing like that ever repeats? How is it going to be controlled? I really hope common sense tells everyone how it's going to look like, what it's going to look like. Who's going to give orders to cease the hostilities? And what will be the price of those orders? Just imagine 2,000 kilometers. Who's going to determine who? Who broke the ceasefire along those 2,000 kilometers? And who's going to lay blame on others for breaking this agreement? Those are all issues that require very careful studying from both sides. So the very idea is great, I think it's correct, and we, of course, support it. There are, though, certain issues that we still need to look into and to discuss. And we need to hold consultations with our American partners, counterparts. Maybe we need to have a phone talk with President Trump to discuss that with him as well. But the very idea of ending this conflict in a peaceful manner, we support that.
He simply says that the idea is so nice to think of, but how can we implement that? The various issues that he has raised during his response. What's your take on the way that Russians are thinking of a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia?
Well, first of all, we have to stop pretending that all this took place in a vacuum. We have to stop pretending that this narrative began in Riyadh earlier this week with a dialogue between the United States and Ukraine, and that somehow what came out of that dialogue was new and innovative and earth-shattering, and that Russia is receiving this for the first time, and that for the first time Russia is going back to the United States with its response. This is absurd in the extreme. This is a narrative that began, back during the campaign when President Trump, then candidate Trump, was given horrible advice by his principal advisor on Ukraine, Keith Kellogg. Horrible advice. And that advice turned into policy formulations that were unrealistic, both in terms of timelines and expectations. Expectations about how Russia would respond and what America could do to bring to the table. Unfortunately, we saw that Keith Kellogg's pronouncements were embraced by the Secretary of Treasury designate, Scott Bessent, who has become the Secretary of Treasury, who has made ridiculous comments about pressure that can be put on Russia economically, comments that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, bought into and repeated. And still, in some ways, continues to articulate that this is his thinking. But a reality check came in the form of Russia just refusing to even engage. Russia wouldn't pick up the phone, wouldn't talk. And the reason why is that they rejected Keith Kellogg's formulations out of hand. This led to Steve Witkoff, who is normally the Middle East envoy, being sent to Russia on February 11th. Why? Why would Witkoff be sent there? Because Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi crown prince, who is very knowledgeable of the Russians, has worked with the Russians intensively. Russia is, after all, a member of the OPEC Plus. So they have constant discussions about not just energy security, but when you're talking energy security, you're talking regional stability. I think sometimes people forget that there is direct connectivity, that you can't have energy security. And if you're an energy producing nation like Saudi Arabia, and your economy is dependent upon the price of oil, and you make budgets based upon the price of oil, what you need is consistency and stability. And regional conflict brings the exact opposite, makes it impossible to balance a budget, makes it impossible to have anything predictable outcomes. And so Saudi Arabia is very interested in stability. And they watched Steve Witkoff come in and seize the reins of authority away from, the Biden administration when it came to the Gaza conflict. Watch how Steve Witkoff behaved and with the Israelis and with others, and was deeply impressed and understood that Steve Witkoff's authority came not from his knowledge of the Middle East. He has none. But his ability to be the vector for Donald Trump, to channel Donald Trump. He was very close with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump trusted him implicitly. And so Mohammed bin Salman called Vladimir Putin and said, "This is the guy that you need to talk to. This is the guy that can get it started." And the hint was dropped. And next thing you know, Steve Witkoff is on his way to Moscow, February 11th, to ostensibly recover a prisoner, Mark Fogel, who had been imprisoned by the Russians for a drug offense. But this wasn't just a prisoner retrieval mission. He met with Vladimir Putin. Now, let me just again, sometimes you got to explain things to people because they don't understand the significance of it. You just don't meet with the Russian president, just like you just don't meet with the American president. When you meet with heads of state of this caliber, there has to be a reason. His time is valuable. Why is he going to allocate time to Steve Witkoff to talk about Mark Vogel? Nope. It's because he wants to take advantage of Witkoff's access to Trump to receive a message and to send a message. And whatever conversation they had resonated greatly. And it wasn't just a meeting between Witkoff and Putin. Putin brought in somebody else, a name that nobody, unless you've been following Russia intimately, like me, nobody knew before this happened. How many people can honestly say that they knew who Kirill Dmitriev was? When they heard that name, most people went to Google and said, who the hell is Kirill Dmitriev? And why is he meeting with Steve Witkoff? What's the importance? Why is the head of Russia's, you know, sovereign investment fund meeting with the emissary of Donald Trump? Because they speak the language of international business, and because Dmitriev was setting Witkoff straight on the reality of the Russian economy, you know, the false expectations that Trump had about certain policy directions that could put pressure on Russia. You need to set the record straight, what can be achieved and what can't be achieved, and to talk about the potential of the economic benefits of a renewed economic relationship. This is broader than just Ukraine. In fact, the conversation appeared to discuss almost everything but Ukraine. Witkoff went back the very next day. Trump has a 90-minute phone call with Donald Trump, with Vladimir Putin. I bring this up again because if you're acting as if what we're hearing from Putin today is the first time he's considered Donald Trump's position, you're wrong. You're fundamentally wrong. He heard Donald Trump's position back on February 12th when they had a 90-minute phone call where they exchanged ideas. This phone call didn't just happen out of the blue. They were both ready for it. They both knew what they wanted to say. They said it. They listened. And then it was followed up by a meeting in Riyadh between the Secretary of State and his counterpart, the Foreign Minister of Russia. It wasn't just them. Michael Waltz, National Security Advisor, met with his counterpart, Mr. Ushakov. And Kirill Dmitriev was there too, meeting with Steve Witkoff. You had three levels of connectivity there. Very detailed exchange of ideas, broader than simply Ukraine. I bring this up because what we're seeing here is theater. That's it. This is theater. You know, Marco Rubio, when he met with the Ukrainian delegation in Riyadh earlier this week, wasn't making a final deal. Rubio knew he wasn't making a final deal. What Rubio was doing was beginning a process, but it was a process that was hampered by several things. One, by the Ukrainians themselves, who up until were refusing to, how can you talk about a negotiated settlement with Russia when the Constitution of Ukraine prohibits negotiation? I mean, this seems to be one of those stumbling blocks. And how do you proceed when, no matter what the President of the United States said, because let's just reiterate what Trump has said is some of the foundational understandings that have been reached between the United States and Russia. A, Russia didn't start this war. Whap! There goes the entire European narrative that this is a war of Russian aggression. Russia didn't start this war. Russia was right to defend its interests. These are fundamental things, guys. Previously, they've been dismissed as Kremlin talking points, but they're not. They're statements of fact, fact-based reality. Two, Ukraine will never be a member of NATO, ever. It's just not going to happen. Boom. Three, there won't be European peacekeeping forces deployed to Ukraine. Isn't going to happen. Boom. And we can go on and on. This is the reality that was set forth. Having articulate, perhaps the most important, the war in Ukraine is a proxy war between the United States and Russia. Ukraine is just a proxy. That's sort of like it, the defining thing. When you have the Secretary of State articulate this, saying this is between us and Russia, we're the warring parties, Ukraine is a proxy. This is fundamental. So because when you say that, you now understand the role that Ukraine plays. They're not driving this ship. They're just the proxy. This ship is being driven by the United States. The United States started this war. The United States is the one who set the objectives of this war, which we know are the strategic defeat of Russia. And Ukraine is simply the proxy. ironically, it's not just that this is a Kremlin talking point. I remember when I was put on the Mir Tvorets death list and put on the Center for Countering Disinformation's hit list. One of the reasons why they said is that I was saying that the war is a proxy conflict between NATO and Ukraine. And that apparently is the death penalty. I'm supposed to be killed because I said that. I found it interesting, the timing of this, because about a week and a half later, the Ukrainian defense minister came out and said, oh, no, 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 this is a proxy war between NATO and Russia, and we're happy to be that. Give us more weapons, and we will serve as your proxy. Guys, this has been known from day one. Only idiots and the mainstream media, I guess they're the same, have been articulating something different. And so now we have, you know, foundational understanding of this conflict. So what is the role of Ukraine? It's an insignificant role. And we saw the way that Donald Trump treated Zelensky in the White House. Dismissive. It was an ambush, time to demean him. And there's a reason for this. What happened in Riyadh? We know Zelensky was in Riyadh. We all saw the photographs of him meeting with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. But the president of Ukraine, why wasn't he heading up the Ukrainian delegation? Why was the presidential advisor heading it up? Because the United States said Zelensky's not welcome at the table. Don't bother. We don't want you there. You're not part of the solution. You are the problem. So again, we have to understand all this when we bring into, you know, try and put context into the statement that Marco Rubio used to initiate everything that you're premising this show on. But there's something else that happened too, because who visited the White House prior to Zelensky's humiliation? Emmanuel Macron and Keir Starmer. And they visited the White House. They tried to articulate Europe's vision of what's going on, which wasn't, by the way, a vision predicated on a ceasefire, but a vision predicated on continuing this conflict until Russia was defeated. Again, let's just make things very clear. Europe was dead set against a ceasefire. The European posture was, we must humble Russia. Russia must be defeated so that Russia knows it can never stand up to Europe again. That's what they said. I'm not making it up. And they met to talk about 800 billion euros worth of infusion of defense funding, getting boots on the ground. The French were talking about getting their nuclear deterrence deployed into Germany, putting air cover over Ukraine. War, 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 war. And now you're Donald Trump saying, I want to bring this war to an end. If I only negotiate with the Russians without bringing in Ukraine, then we have a problem with Europe, because the strategic objective for Donald Trump here is peace and stability in Europe, so the United States can disentangle itself from the European web and reallocate diplomatic, economic, and military resources to the Pacific to deal with the principal issue of China. Never forget that. Ukraine is a sideshow for what Trump wants to do with China. Not military. We talked about this before. I don't believe that Trump's looking for a war with China. I think Trump's looking for an equitable solution to the tensions that exist between China and the United States. That's a whole different negotiating posture and step, and I don't want to bring it up here, except to point out that you can't do that if you're tangled up in a war in Europe. And left to their own devices, the Europeans apparently were willing to have a war with Russia. That would be problematic for the United States. So how do you resolve this? And again, I want to just once again remind your audience that prior to the meeting in Riyadh between Rubio and Yermak, the presidential advisor to the president of Ukraine, Europe was talking about humbling Russia on the battlefield, that there could be no ceasefire, that this war could only end with a Russian military defeat, and Europe was going to be the one to ensure that defeat occurred. That was the European posture. Then Marco Rubio comes out with Mike Waltz, and they talk about, we've agreed to a 30-day ceasefire. And there are certain conditions that the Ukrainians laid out, but it's a 30-day ceasefire, and the ball is in Russia's court. Those are very important words. Why? Because immediately, out of every capital in Europe, came a following statement, almost word for word. We love the idea of a ceasefire. Wait a minute. Didn't you just say that there can't be a ceasefire? Russia must be humbled militarily, defeated. But now Europe's saying, we love a ceasefire. It's the greatest thing. And the ball is now in Russia's court. They said it. Everybody said the same thing over and over again, which means that this was scripted. What the United States did is trap Europe. That's what happened in Riyadh. It's not about trapping the Russians. Everybody, oh, look, we outflanked the Russians. You never outflank the Russians. How do you outflank somebody named Sergei Lavrov that's been around forever, who's been doing this forever? Vladimir Putin has been the leader of Russia for a quarter of a century. These Russians are better prepared. They know more. They know about themselves. They know about the world. They know about everybody. This is not their first rodeo. This is not their fifth rodeo. This is not their 1,000th rodeo. They invented the frickin' rodeo. And so they, you don't outmaneuver the Russians. But Donald Trump outmaneuvered Europe. Because now Europe is committed to not war, but a ceasefire. Europe has said that is the best outcome. That is the outcome we want, a ceasefire. And the ball is in Russia's court. What's important about that term? It implies a process. I mean, it's a reference to a game. They didn't say, take it or leave it, Russia. No one said that. They said, the ball's in your court. So that's like a tennis thing, you know? They just hit the ball into Russia's court. Now, that ball can either score a point in the match, or Russia will volley it back. Game on. And look at what Russia's done. Listen to what Vladimir Putin said. Ceasefire is essential. Essential. We accept a ceasefire. We accept it. They're playing the game. You see what happened there? They're
balls playing the back.
But then they went backhand back and said, but there are conditions. Now, here's the interesting thing about the conditions. They didn't send the ball back into the Ukrainian court because they don't give a damn about the Ukrainians. They didn't send it back into the European court because Europe, frankly speaking, took themselves out of the game the moment they said, we accept the ceasefire. They went to the American court. And the Americans are receiving the Russian statement today, except this isn't the first time they heard this, Nima. It's the second time or the third time they've heard this. Nothing new is being presented to the Americans. Nothing new. And they will make sure that that point's driven home. When, as Putin said, maybe there needs to be a phone call between us and Trump. When you have the president of Russia and the president of the United States speaking on such an important issue, that's bad news for Europe and that's bad news for Ukraine. Because the United States is going to agree to most, if not all, of Russia's conditions. Because it's a game we started. We got Ukraine to agree to play the game. And then we got Europe to buy into the rules of the game. And now the Russians are saying reality-based, because that's the other thing that the Trump administration kept talking about, whether it's Pete Hegseth or whether it was J.D. Vance, whether it's Marco Rubio, whether it's the president himself, that we have to be dealing with the situation as it exists on the ground, the reality of it. And Russia is about to set forth the definition of what reality is. I don't think that this is going to be the last negotiation, but I think this is the most important negotiation. Everything else was a setup for this. The Ukrainians have committed to a process. Europe has bought into the process. Russia agrees to the process. We have a tennis match. And now Russia is sending the ball back, but the player isn't Ukraine. First of all, let's understand the following. Zelensky has been sidelined. The United States humiliated him in Washington, D.C., and then he was in Riyadh meeting with the Crown Prince, but he wasn't allowed to be the head of the delegation. He's the problem, not the solution. And right now, inside in Kiev, you hear talk now that he's out. He's done. And my guess is that he'll be out of there within 2 weeks. I don't know where he physically is right now. I don't know if he's on the sidelines of the G7 meeting. I don't know if he returned to Kiev, but he can't last long in Kiev. He's been discredited as a leader, humiliated as a leader. And he has once again directly contradicted the United States after a meeting where his negotiating team received information from Marco Rubio about territorial concessions, that this isn't going back to 2014 or 2022. It's dealing with the reality that exists today. And the Ukrainian delegation went, yeah, we understand that. Zelensky came out and said, no, 2014. We get everything back. We get all of Novorossiya, you know, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Lugansk, and we get Crimea. That's the only term. He is so far removed from reality, it's not even funny. So he's finished. It's the end of Zelensky. And when Zelensky goes, you're going to see a collapse of Ukraine, political will, social will. And all Russia has to do is keep the game playing until Ukraine gets into a position where they will comply with Russia's demands. And Europe will have no choice but to follow along. This is the game that's being played. It's called diplomacy. It's a masterclass being put on by the Russians. And I believe with the assistance of the United States. Who's not in Moscow right now from the United States? Marco Rubio. Not there. Why? Why isn't the Secretary of State, who has been involved in these negotiations, not present for the most important negotiation? Because he's always been a figurehead. There's somebody else pulling the strings, somebody else calling the shots. And Rubio isn't needed for this. In fact, he's a distraction from this because Rubio has tainted himself with the Ukrainian brush and the European brush. So he's over there now playing with Europe. Well, what happened to the last person who was supposed to be the one leading the efforts and then got sidelined and sent to Europe? His name was Keith Kellogg. You do know that he was fired. He's no longer the special envoy. I'm not saying that Rubio is going to be fired. I'm going to say that Rubio is not going to be a major part of the Russian negotiation going forward. This is now in Donald Trump's hands. Steve Witkoff, although they said he's not going to be the principal negotiator, Steve Witkoff is the facilitator. And he's got this in Trump's hands. And I think that once Trump and Putin nail down the basics, they'll bring in a closer who will come in and close the deal. And that's going to happen in a matter of weeks. I think Zelensky's going to be gone. The Ukrainian government collapses. Now you have the conditions to where Russia can come in and participate in a post-conflict election that gets their man installed, gets a parliament, a Rada installed that's willing to make the constitutional changes that Russia views as a prerequisite for denazification, who will agree to demilitarization on the terms set forth by Russia. And Europe will have no choice but to comply with this. This is what happened in Riyadh. Europe was trapped into a position where a ceasefire is now the primary policy objective, as opposed to humbling Russia, defeating Russia, all the things they were talking about. That's not being talked about now. They're talking about, you know, the necessity of a ceasefire. This is the game. We're moving towards a ceasefire. The conditions that need to be met to make a ceasefire possible.